Blog Talk Radio.
The man you're about to see and hear, should you be so foolish as to have just joined us, is Ray Charles.
Hello. All right. 3, 4.
I got something, y'all, in my bones. Make me want to shout hallelujah. And I want to sing along. Lift every voice and sing, till it in heaven rain. Ring with the harmony, oh, liberty. Let our rejoicing rise high. Loud as the Lord see.
Testing. Hope that y'all can hear me loud and clear. Trying to make sure everything is on point. What's going on? We didn't have a show yesterday. My producer, Ebony, was celebrating holidays a little bit too extra. She didn't get in. But today, what we're going to do is be dealing with some election integrity, some voting rights. And we're just going to talk about the news of the day, what's really going on. Don't forget, you can go to TillmanFamilyPress.com and pick up Tillman's Handbook of Great Black American Patriots. It's doing very well. If you're in Chicago, you can go to Frontline Bookstores in Hyde Park, and I think there's one on Cottage Grove. I'm not sure. Okay, but we're going to do with that. I got Christine McGovern's coming in. She's running for office. We're going to hear a little bit about what she's talking about there and see what she feels about voting rights and election integrity. We're also going to be probably tapping into these vaccine mandates that the city is now putting in the county, are now putting on its citizens. But you know what I found very interesting? The other day, Joe Biden admitted, I'm going to play a little clip from it today. He admitted that the federal government has nothing to do with states' rights and how they administer their vaccines. So basically saying the federal government is out of it. Don't ask me for nothing. Now, a lot of people run around clapping like, he failed, it's a failure, yada, 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 yada. He made a promise to end the to stop the pandemic, yada, 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 yada. But this is how I see it. It's an election year. And by placing these restrictions upon the governors, and most of these governors are running, they can easily shut down this election. Like here in Chicago, JB got enough money to make sure no one else campaigns, no one else fundraises by putting in mandates in and restrictions. Now, if you're Republican and most Republicans aren't vaccinated, you know, most of us believe in our God-given rights and our constitutional rights, so we didn't get the venom. You got the venom, I'm not shitting on you, but most of us does not have it. So that put us at a dilemma. That places us at a disadvantage. So maybe that is what's happening. I don't know, but I just find it strange. You know, find it real strange. It also puts the ball back in the hands of the Illinoisans that can demand justice. It also puts the hand, you know, with the ball back in their court. And so we're going to be doing a little bit like that. I'm going to, before I bring my callers, I'm going to play a little election integrity sample, take a break. I'm going to come back. I'm going to see who he has on the line. Ebby just stepped in, and we'll go from there. But let me just play a little segment of a little information. Mama D gave us a lot of information on the For the People Act and the this voting integrity. I mean, the Voting Rights Act they're trying to pass by. I'm trying to bring it back on again to educate my audience again about it because a lot of them has not read it. I'm going to try to pull some audio up. You have Ebony bring it up, but that's what we're going to do right there. So let me get some water, and we're going to let me repeat it, Ebony. We're going to just do a little Republican fight for election integrity versus Democrat fights to secure voters' rights. It's a little toss-up. I'm just put the information out there, both sides, and we're going to decide from right there, and we're going to debate it from right there. But after this, I'm taking a break, so be with me, y'all.
Dozen election bills that they say will ensure more secure elections.
But Democrats claim some of the bills could end up restricting access to the polls. The bills are on the governor's desk just 1 week after Democrats on Capitol Hill failed to secure enough votes to open up debate on a bill they say would have expanded access to the polls and prevent efforts to make it harder to vote.
Brian Jenkins filed this report earlier. It goes 360 on the issue of election legislation to gain a deeper perspective.
Some say Republicans are trying to restrict access to the polls, but Republicans argue they're focused on restoring election integrity.
To dive deeper into different perspectives, we're going 360 on recent voters' rights legislation. We hear from Republican lawmakers about why they say federal attempts to create a federal standard surrounding national elections were not supported by Republicans last week, as states like Wisconsin work to pass election integrity bills. We also hear from the former governor of Massachusetts, Deval Patrick, now the co-chair of the American Bridge 21st Century Foundation. He shares why the For the People Act was about making polls more accessible and why he says Republicans, like Senator Johnson, let Wisconsinites down. But first, we start with the perspective of Wisconsin's Democratic Senator, Tammy Baldwin.
We're seeing all this activity at the state level intended to make it harder for people to access the ballot box.
Senator Baldwin points to Republican-backed election integrity legislation as she argues that Wisconsin Republicans are working to restrict access to polls, while she says she and her Democratic colleagues are working to expand access and protect voters' rights. Right now, there are more than a dozen bills awaiting action from Governor Evers. One would change the rules for voters in nursing homes, no longer allowing staff to assist residents in the process. Another would prohibit any individual from helping more than one non-family member and returning an absentee ballot. And another proposed bill would no longer allow voters who are indefinitely confined or overseas to receive absentee ballots automatically. Then there's the federal legislation.
In many ways, this bill would help create national standards for the conduct of federal elections that would prevent these type of efforts that are focused on making it more difficult for people to vote.
The For the People Act, which Republicans filibustered last week, would have created automatic voter registration and would have expanded access to early and absentee voting. It would have also changed campaign finance laws. In a statement to TMJ4 News, Senator Ron Johnson called the bill a monstrosity, saying in part, quote, "Republicans want to restore confidence in our elections by making it easy to vote but hard to cheat. It seems like Democrats primarily want to make it easier to cheat. Why else would they propose eliminating voter ID laws, require ballot harvesting and drop boxes, make the FEC a partisan agency, and make it harder to maintain accurate voter files?" Republican State Representative Adam Nealon says the state-level legislation would not make it harder to access polls, but would make it more difficult to cheat.
Whether or not you believe there was a massive level of fraud this past election, we really have seen ways that our election process could be vulnerable to something like that. So we think that the best way to address that is by making sure that we make it more difficult to cheat, and we also restore that trust in the election process.
It's important to note that there have been no confirmed cases of widespread voter fraud reported in Wisconsin following this most recent election. Deval Patrick, former governor of Massachusetts and current co-chair of the American Bridge 21st Century Foundation, disagrees with the Republicans and says Republicans' lack of support in the federal legislation is disappointing but not surprising.
Every single Republican senator bound together not to vote against the provisions of the For the People Act, which was about making it easier, but to vote against the idea of even debating the question of how to make voting more transparent, more reliable, and to engage more people. And that is a fundamentally undemocratic vote.
It's been reported that Governor Evers is set to veto the Republican-backed election integrity bills, which were sent to him last week. Meanwhile, Democrats on Capitol Hill are vowing to double down on their efforts to pass voters' rights legislation in the weeks ahead. Ryan Jenkins, TMJ4 News.
This is
Grammarly
your home.
Can't teach you to dance,
this is
but
your
it
family.
Can help you make a great impression for free. As you type, Grammarly ensures you come across confidently, so your application stands out from the crowd. Here's to putting your best foot forward. Nail your delivery every time you write with Grammarly. Click the blue button below to try Grammarly for free.
What is an election integrity? is the integrity of our election at stake? Now, unbeknownst to a lot of people out there, the For the People Act, the election integrity, a lot of black people are not for it. They're not for the John Lewis Act. They're not for the People Act. Now, I'm going to bring on someone who can probably educate you and talk it to you in your language. And I'm about to bring in Mama D. And she's going to give it down because she's been looking at this real with a microscope. And she's been going at it, been on a mountaintop screaming her lungs out about why these bills are not right, especially for black people. And about this election integrity. Now, what people don't realize that, well, I'll let Mama D come in. I don't want to hog the whole spot. Let me bring you in right now. Mama D, how you doing there? You hear me? You got it in there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me? All right. Okay. How you doing? I'm sorry for yesterday. Today.
No problem. Hallelujah. Greetings for Barney Garney. That means what the news in Swahili. So the answer is when a person says Habari Gani, Ujama, the word of the day, collective work and responsibility. So that's the response. When it's during Kwanzaa, whatever the principle is, you say, what's the news, Habari Gani, and then you say, Ujama. That's the news for today, collective work and responsibility. And that sort of fits right into what we are talking about. I have written it's an open letter, and I intend to send it to the U.S. senators and U.S. congressmen. It's 2 pages, but I think that it will answer most of the questions about John Lewis Act. So I'm speaking tonight as an advocate for indigenous Native Black American rights. As I said before, if you are in the country before it becomes a country, 1619 came before 1776, that makes you indigenous. So we need to claim our indigenous Native American African. Why American Africa? Because claiming the continent, when the people living on the continent don't claim it, does not do us any good. And we will continue to be, as Reverend Dr. Prophet King said, treated like exiles in our own land. Because, like it or not, facts can change feelings, but feelings can't change facts. There is no country called Negro, Black, people of color, Afro-America, Afro-descendants, no country named that. And the people living on the country, Ghana, Kenya, Liberia, they say, I'm from Ghana. They living on the continent, and they don't claim the continent. So does it make sense to you that we should be claiming a continent that has no standing? So I want to deal with that. So as an advocate for indigenous Native Black American rights, Richard Wright said a long time ago, Native son. So we need to claim our indigenous Native Black American rights. So anyhow, the title of this that I intend to, if it be the will, send it to the U.S. Senate and Congress, it's entitled The John Lewis Bill Advances Privileges for People of Color and Reduces the Rights of Descendants of Enslavement. If you thought black and people of color were the same, think again. They are not. Black has no standard in law. According to former President Barack Obama, a son of immigrants who called himself the first Kenyan-American president, Vice President Kamala Harris, a daughter of immigrants, often praises her Asian mother and said she was not going to do anything just for blacks. But after six Asians were killed, within weeks, they had an anti-hate Asian bill just for them that came with $50 million. However, blacks can't even get a hearing on H.R. 40, a bill that is 30 years old and comes with no money. It's a reparation study, and Speaker of the House, Pelosi, is not pushing for the three votes needed because she says it will hurt the election. Now, what happened to kidnapped and enslaved captives from the continent of Africa did not happen to immigrants, who are mostly people of color. However, they did not have their tribal language removed by the transatlantic slave traders, who renamed them Negroes because it meant black in Spanish. As stated in the June 18, 2009 United States Senate and Congress apology for enslavement and Jim Crow segregation laws, they were stripped of their names and heritage. The dreams of non-citizen sanctuary settlers are coming true, while descendants of the enslaved are still living a nightmare. People of color are being set up while the vestiges of 345 years of federal, state, and local crimes against humanity and Jim Crow genocide continues to be ignored is a setback for blacks. The John Lewis Voters Rights Advancement Act highlights the difference in a way that is detrimental to black voters. They are not immigrants or bilingual, and English is their mother tongue language, although American English is the official language in only 29 states. If you were not born in America, in order to become a U.S. citizen, you must pass a naturalized citizenship test that requires you to read, write, and speak English to have a legal right to vote in federal, state, and local elections. Should I continue? Got any questions? Okay. The John Lewis bill nullifies this citizenship requirement. This is the point. This is where the harm is. The John Lewis bill nullifies this citizenship requirement by adding a category called membership in a language minority group that includes the people of color. The red people of color consist of American Indians or Alaskan Natives, Navajo Nation, Blackfeet Tribe, Mayans, Osage Native Village, Traditional Government, Nahomi Eskimo Community, etc., and they are in the membership category. The yellow people of color consist of Asian Americans. That includes Chinese, Filipinos, Asian Indians, Vietnamese, Koreans, Japanese, the Native Hawaiians, and other Pacific Islanders. They are in the membership category. The brown people of color consist of Spanish origins, includes Hispanic heritage, white and non-white, Mexicans, Latinos, Puerto Ricans, Cubans, Salvadorians, Dominicans, Colombians, Guatemalans, Spaniards, Ecuadorians, etc., are in the membership category. The white people without a color, consisting of Germans, Irish, English, Italians, Lebanese, Egyptians, etc., are not in the membership category. American Africans or blacks, consisting of Jamaicans, Haitians, Nigerians, Ethiopians, Somalians, are not included in the category of membership in a language minority group because they are different from the colorless people and are different from the people of color. Yet the bill named after a black man benefits people of color, and it is doing harm to blacks by promoting bilingual preferred when they are not bilingual or immigrants. In Chicago, blacks are struggling over three wards to be taken from the black community and given to brown people of color and the yellow people of color. They want a ward of their own. which will decrease the political empowerment of blacks, is a setback. The John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act sanctions this fundamental unfairness by legalizing bilingual preferred policies.
But Mama
D, needs to be amended. Yes.
No, I'm going to cut you off. Now, you know, always be like, man, you be breaking it down. Why aren't other people like yourself and your little groups that you be rolling with, how come they can't see this writing on the wall that we got these politicians that are placing policies to set us back? And this is obvious. You see, we don't have nobody explaining to us what is in these bills. They, you know, want to say voting rights, because it's something that I think rings a bell. It's a tricky word for black people. But in the end, you know, it's for other, like, people don't understand. I got to take another break. People understand, in a minute, Mother Jim, come back to you. And I see Christina will come back to you in a minute, too. But people understand that back in the Barack Obama days, they had tried to change the Voting Rights Act, and they did some miscalculations, try to put, I guess, this John Lewis information inside the Voting Rights Act. So they sent it back up, sent it up to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court shot it down. And you see, this John Lewis Act, what people don't realize, is the answer to the Supreme Court, where Hispanics and other minorities was trying to get the same privilege that the Voting Rights Act had for the descendants of slaves and give equal footing. And so I want to say that the language they put in there, they sit back. And this is why we're going through this right now. We're playing with the mental stability of black people by saying our rights are being violated. And I'm going to do a show. I'm going to need everybody across America to call me and let me know how you've been discriminated against in the 21st century. What are the Jim Crow laws in the 21st century that's stopping you from voting? And please don't say standing in long lines. Please don't say that. Please don't say no water. Please just tell me what's really holding you back. It might not be the long lines. What I'm going to do, Mama D, I'm going to take a break. We'll come back to you. And then come to you, Christine, too. We'll keep going right here. This is Jimmy Underground Radio Network. Be back in about 5 minutes.
Church town, there's a gold dirt road to a whole lot of nothing. Got a deed to the land, but it ain't my ground. This is God's country. We pray for rain, thank him when it's falling, cause it brings a grain and a little bit of money. We put it back in the plate, I guess that's why they call it God's country. I saw the light in a sunrise sitting back in a 40 on the muddy riverside, getting baptized in holy water and shine with the dogs running. Sunday, then do it all.
Great. Kamala sat down with Charlemagne the God, a popular radio and television host, on his Comedy Central show, The God's Honest Truth. And this clip from the interview went viral.
So who's the real president of this country? Is it Joe Manchin or Joe Biden, Madam Vice President?
Come on, Charlemagne. It's Joe Biden.
I can't tell.
No. It's Joe Biden. And don't start talking like a Republican about asking whether or not he's president.
Do you think Joe Manchin is a problem?
It's Joe Biden, and I'm vice president, and my name is Kamala Harris.
Cringe, yikes. If you're like me, that clip was just another addition in a long list of reasons why Kamala Harris is not your favorite politician. I mean, listen, if you have to snarkily tell people Biden is the president, that you're the vice president, and what your name is, maybe Charlemagne's question wasn't so off the mark after all. And what's worse is Simone Sanders, Kamala's senior advisor, actually tried to run interference and protect Kamala from having to answer the question before she could answer for herself.
Who's the superhero that's going to speak against Joe Manchin? I want to know who's the real president of this country. Is it Joe Biden or Joe Manchin?
I'm sorry. I interrupted. I'll take the vice president here. It's Simone. I'm so sorry, Charlie. We have to wrap.
She can hear me.
Can you hear me now?
Can you hear me, Madam Vice President?
Oh, I'm sorry. You got a wrap. Oh. So I'm sorry to interrupt.
They're acting like they can't hear me.
What is that? This is such a problem in and of itself. Why are people like Simone and those surrounding Biden protecting them from answering questions from citizens of this country? They are elected leaders. They work for us. They shouldn't be considered so elite they're shielded from answering to us. Yet it happens all the time with Biden and now Kamala as well. This makes me angry. But nonetheless, Kamala answered. We got the snark, and many people said, see, this is why Simone didn't want her to answer. They didn't want a clip like this to go viral and make Kamala look worse than she already does. But here's where it gets interesting. There were a lot of Democrats who actually liked that exchange. When The Hill ran this headline, people scoffed at it and accused the organization of running interference for Harris. I can assure you, The Hill has no interest in running interference for her or anyone. We diss Kamala all the time, but it's hard to believe as it is. Yes, that exchange actually scored Kamala a few points. So much so, we might end up seeing more of this snarky Kamala to come, and it might be the path Democrats take, thinking it could rescue Kamala from her sinking ship of terrible ratings. To understand why, we have to go back to whatever made Kamala even somewhat popular to begin with. What put Kamala Harris on the presidential primary map was her questioning of Brett Kavanaugh during his confirmation hearings. Remember this?
Are you saying that with all that you remember, you have an impeccable memory? You've been speaking for almost 8 hours, I think more, with this committee about all sorts of things you remember. Yeah. How can you not remember whether or not you had a conversation about Robert Mueller or his investigation with anyone at that law firm? This investigation has only been going on for so long, sir. So
right, I'm not sure I'm just trying to think, do I know anyone who works at that firm? I might know.
That's not my question. My question is, have you had a conversation with anyone at that firm about that investigation? It's a really specific question.
I would like to know the person you're thinking of, because what if there's...
I think you're thinking of someone and you don't want to tell us.
People loved Prosecutor Kamala's blistering questions of Kavanaugh, and it was the standout moment that threw her into the spotlight. It was after this exchange when rumblings began about Harris possibly running for president. And once Kamala did decide to throw her hat into the ring, we can't forget what launched her ahead of the other candidates for a short period of time during the primaries.
So on the issue of race, I couldn't agree more that this is an issue that is still not being talked about truthfully and honestly. There is not a black man I know, be he a relative, a friend, or a coworker, who has not been the subject of some form of profiling or discrimination. Growing up, my sister and I had to deal with the neighbor who told us her parents couldn't play with us because we were black. And I will say also that in this campaign, we've also heard, and I'm going to now direct this at Vice President Biden, I do not believe you are a racist. And I agree with you when you commit yourself to the importance of finding common ground. But I also believe, and it's personal, and it was hurtful to hear you talk about the reputations of two United States senators who built their reputations and career on the segregation of race in this country. And it was not only that, but you also worked with them to oppose busing. And, you know, there was a little girl in California who was part of the second class to integrate her public schools. And she was bused to school every day. And that little girl was me.
There was Kamala once again going after powerful men, and people were gobbling it up like a Thanksgiving turkey. After Kamala's supposed takedown of Biden, her ratings went from 8% to 17%, launching her to the front of the Democratic primary pack. She fundraised $2 million in the 24 hours following the debate and was declared by many in the media as the unofficial winner of the evening. Her popularity was short-lived because Kamala's strength only comes out in these rare moments. The rest of the time, she spends blubbering around, backtracking and flip-flopping on issues. And when asked tough questions herself, she giggles. Plus, we can't forget Kamala was then herself a victim of her own tactics when Tulsi Gabbard slashed her during a later debate, effectively ending her primary run. Now, people want strong Kamala. They don't want weak Kamala. The giggling, flip-flopping, and the ability for others to poke holes in her own sordid past is a problem that's likely not going away. But there's no doubt. People love seeing Kamala Harris get snarky and go after others. It's been the thing time and time again that has helped her move from being mediocre and forgettable to being perceived as strong and exhibiting some sort of leadership qualities.
I just want you to know that Madam Vice President, that Kamala Harris, that's the one I like. That's the one that was putting the pressure on people in Senate hearings. That's the one I'd like to see more often out here in these streets.
There is way more to being a leader than prosecuting others, and I'd even argue that the trait is detrimental to our nation. Not beneficial in a position of leadership when you need to be the leader of everyone, not just some. It's more valuable, in my opinion, to have someone who is strong in their convictions and less divisive than it is to have someone extremely divisive and flip-flop on everything. But nonetheless, if the Democratic strategists are looking to resuscitate Kamala Harris's vice presidency and keep her as Biden's running mate in 2024, this exchange between her and Charlemagne the God was probably a reminder of what made her popular in the first place. And it's likely they'll try to run less interference in the future and instead will encourage this sort of snarky behavior going forward. So, Ryan, I'm going to ask you if you think this snarky Kamala, if they're going to go forward with this and if you think it would actually work.
No, I mean, I think that people who are into that snarky Kamala are already in the percentage of people who are approving of her so far, which is in the 20s or 30s, depending on the poll. So, which actually is, that's tens of millions of people. That's who that appeals to. And I don't think you break out with that. I think the bigger problem that you saw in that clip is Kamala Harris's inability to be a good manager. And so, and that's the thing that has, eviscerated every attempt of hers to move to a higher level. And then, when she collapses, the recriminations from her current and former staff then spill out into the New York Times or Politico or the Washington Post. And what you saw there was a staffer who was worried that if she allowed that question to go forward, might get in trouble afterwards. And so, did the most aggressive thing because that's the safer thing from a staffer perspective, because you did something, so she can't then later say, why didn't somebody do something? Well, I did something. Turned out that something was bad, and it made her look ridiculous. It made her look overcoached. And it's that combination of being overcoached and being a poor manager, which I think is going to be the thing that fundamentally holds her back.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think with Trump, it worked, right? Him being really snarky, going after others. People loved that about him. And I think they also liked that about Ron DeSantis. And I do think they really love that about Kamala Harris. I think what people are disappointed in is they're not seeing more of that. They were hoping to get that kind of prosecutor bulldog. But Robbie, what do you think?
Yeah, the cringy part of that, the Charlemagne interview, the handler trying to be like, oh no, this is over, we can't, like, that's hard to watch and kind of speaks to her ability to continue engaging this person. I think Harris is sunk not really by her, how snarky she is, if that's what you want to call it, but she's just sunk by a lack of principles or lack of a discernible ideological views, or like, where do you position her on the spectrum? What are her ideas? She's just mutated them too many times and didn't really seem, you know, like she was very committed to is this the prosecutor? Is this this kind of social justice? Is she a moderate? Is she, you know, is she part of the progressive left? Is she a class person? Is she a race issue person? She's never picked a lane, and she's never seemed very committed to
right.
one way or the other. So I think that's what holds her back the most.
Trump and DeSantis are committed to the bit. She's never fully committed to the bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that's Kamala's biggest downfall is the flip-flopping and the giggling when she's asked a tough question. I mean, people want a leader that actually is going to have some kind of conviction, and we don't really know what Kamala Harris stands for. Seems like she stands
for nothing.
Well, that's the problem, right? One minute she says something, and then she backtracks and changes her mind mere hours later when talking to the press. And this happened over and over and over during her presidency campaign.
Biden in the clip you played right later, she was like, oh, come on. You know, that was just politics or whatever.
And now
it was.
She's
you know,
vice president.
That was like a really but that was a very cruel and biting
right.
thing you accused him of. And then just to be like, yeah, I didn't really mean it. That was not a
yeah.
good look.
It was just a place where we're supposed to air our views about public affairs. So I was just lying.
Yeah. I definitely don't think there's anything that can fully resuscitate her. I don't think she's ever going to be really well-liked. I don't think the public's ever going to take to her. But I am curious to see what they try to do to try to get her at least somewhat boosted a little bit in the ratings.
She should, like, attack the far left. I mean, that was I keep stealing this line because it was a great line. Matt Iglesias, I think, in his Substack said this. Why doesn't she, like, make fun of the San Francisco School Board for, you know, renaming schools? Do that kind of stuff that Obama himself did some of, right? So, oh, you crazy college kids who don't believe in free speech, you're wrong. Like, she could do that. It would make her instantly more popular. But, alas, she's not.
Yeah, that's my little Democrat breakdown, y'all vice president. If you saw the Comedy Central, it would have made you cringe too. It was a cringe-like moment. Hold on, put up my headphones for off. Give me that. How it sound now? Hear me now? My headphones acting up. I put them on like that. Okay, we do. Headphones acting up, but that's that. I'm gonna bring you back in, Mama D. Then I'll bring in Christine. But before I bring you in, Mama, I just want you to just help me understand. You know, because you know I'm Republican, and most of my circle are GOP Republican. That's all my circle, and so I don't be around a lot of Democrats like you do. You're around a lot of the Kwanzaa celebrators. I like to call them the pro-black radicals who care about the condition of black America that I know. My question is, with this information that you have, and I'm quite sure you're talking to them about it, why haven't they gathered up or... Why haven't they done anything or said anything? Is it that they've been holding to the Democratic Party that much they don't want to speak out to make noise and make waves, or just be quiet? We keep our mouths fed. I don't know. Help me out. If they're doing what you said they're doing, like passing these state laws to remove us from this Voting Rights Act. Places out of here, everybody rights and benefits besides us. Why isn't people upset? Help me out. I don't
understand. I don't think that people comprehend what I'm saying. They are trying to put that voting rights bill has some other portions in it. They, for instance, this vote, they want to eliminate voter ID. Well, we are born in America. We have birth certificates. We have a Social Security card. We have no problems with ID. You have to have an ID to cash a welfare check or paycheck to get into a building. So the only people that don't want the ID are the people that can't get the ID. These border breakers over here, these sanctuary settlers that are non-citizens, they don't want ID. Everybody in America has ID. You go to a hospital, you don't get any kind of goods and services without showing some kind of ID of who you are. And so why would we want to eliminate having to have an ID? That's not about us. Use your common sense. That's not about us, because we can get an ID. The only ones who can't are these sanctuary settlers that want to vote without, because they were counted. They wasn't counted as three-fifths of a human being. They were counted, and now they have the numbers, and they are not even citizens, and we are suffering the consequences. So getting back to, and they are putting back in the portion, rewording it, that the Supreme Court took out. But the harmful aspect of this is what I is this category that they have added. We are used to no discrimination based on race, creed, and color. They have removed the word creed, taken it away. So it says race, color, or this category. Membership in a limited language minority group. That when it says minority, we're raising our hands as if they're talking about us. They're not. They are limited just to two groups. And the Haitian group, you're not included. And the colorless people without color group, you're not included. It's limited to the Asians, the Indians, and the Latinos, three groups right there. Now, what is wrong when you go to see or get a job today in Chicago? You know what they say? Bilingual preferred. You are not bilingual. We're the only people over here that are not bilingual. We are not immigrants. When Christopher Columbus came over here, he named the people that were here, the natives of the land, he named them Indians because he was lost and thought he was in India. He named them that. It's just like the Spaniards named Negroes because it means black in Spanish. But these are not our names. These are not our tribal names. But there was no America until 1776. So we were here before 1776. That makes us indigenous. We've got to claim our indigenous status. Indigenous Native Americans, indigenous Native American Africans. So that all the things that the red man has under his indigenous status, we need the same thing. Exempt status, culture rights, sovereignty, land, and money. But let me please get back to the point that I am trying to bring home, that category that is added. What it does, it eliminates the two ways that you can become a citizen. You're either born in America, and only the red man and the black man, the savage and the slave, could be born in America and not be citizens in the land of their birth. So we got our citizenship under the 14th Amendment that says, every person born. If you're not born, you must be naturalized. And what they are doing, the naturalized requirement, you must read, write, and speak in English. So they are removing that category. So everything that you see in English, you must reproduce it in all these other language groups. So you got to have, they gave you the litany list of the Asians. You got to have that, your voting rights, anything connected with voting, newspaper articles, ballots, all of that has to be reproduced in the language that these people had before they got over here. And they're not supposed to be citizens and not able to vote if they haven't passed the natural citizenship law. if that's why only citizens can vote legally in federal, state, and local elections. But if this bill goes through, the ones that are going to suffer are the ones that are not bilingual.
But now,
because the
for H.R. 1, the For the People bill, and the John Lewis Act hasn't been passed yet. They're going to try to put it to the Senate. They're going to try to make it seem like it's a racist thing because it's going to get overturned or blocked, what have you, because it's restructuring our election. But before it even gets there, because you know everybody's going to say they're racist, they don't care about our rights, our voting rights, they don't really care. What I don't know, because I'm about to find out pretty soon. I'm gonna be out there in a minute. But I would like to know, why isn't your friends informed of this, and why aren't I hearing the people who think they know something? You know, everybody hears something on repeat, some hot, some brand new, some fresh. Why is no one saying that this John Lewis Act, the For the People Act, is setting blacks back? Why aren't your compadres, your homeboys and homegirls, why aren't they repeating this? I'm quite sure you're screaming it out, Mama D. I hear you all the time on my mother's show talking about it. You've been saying it for months and months and months. I'm saying, what's the problem? What's the problem?
It's very hard. It's very hard in 30 seconds to try to get any point across. That's why I was reading this letter to go through the entire process. But it's very difficult. If I was a guest on a show, I might be able to get it done. But this is the harm. The groups are limited. So if you don't have enough respect for America to learn about citizenship and take that citizenship test and become a naturalized citizen, you can't vote. If that slides through, it nullifies the naturalized citizenship test. It eliminates that. You won't have to deal with that because this bill says you've got to put everything in the language that I had before I got over here, which absolutely makes no sense. But when you pick up a phone, you pick up a piece of paper, it's got English and it's got Spanish. Why? Because American English is not the official language in America. There's only 29 states that has the English language as an official language. We all thought it was, but it's official when it comes to that naturalized citizenship test. You're supposed to read, write, and speak English in order to pass it and become a citizen. So what this is, it really divides the United States because it says everybody that came over here from some other land, all those countries that I named, Japan, Korea, they were countries. But they're down as minorities. And we have been competing with all of these people calling themselves minorities, and they were powerful enough to go to war with America. But they are under minorities, and they only came up with minorities when we had that Kerner report that set us that thing for enslavement people. And then when the money started flowing, everybody jumped in, and the language changed from black to minorities. But these are countries. So what I'm saying, I hope that just make this one clear point. Everything that has to do with voting will have to be put in the language of where they came from, and it will nullify, void, vacate having to pass the naturalized citizenship test. And now when it comes to the Jamaicans or the Haitians, they are not in the language group. So when they go into a voting place, the voting material is not going to be in their language. The people in Nevada, they were Haitians, and they were speaking a different language. But they are not when you pick up something to vote, they're not in that group. That group is limited to Latinos, Asians, and Native Americans. So we must claim our American citizenship. We cannot survive on black, because there is no land called black, Negro, colored, people of color, black and brown. There's no land. Everybody came from a land with a language that you can find on a map, except we who were stolen from a continent. We're the only ones in this category, and that makes English our mother tongue language, because if you read the June 18, 2009 United States Congress apology for enslavement and Jim Crow segregation laws, they include two presidents, former President Bill Clinton and George Bush, and guess what? They said the vestiges still exist today. So people, I hear them saying, they ought to apologize. They already have. June 18, 2009, Google it, look it up. But it's a paragraph in there that says you were dehumanized and all the stuff that they did, and they took your names and your heritage. So we have a right to claim our mother tongue language, because since 1619, American English is all we have. And we don't need anybody vacating that. We are not immigrants. Immigrants come from a country with a land and a language that you can find on a map.
All right,
so
Mama,
that
Jim,
is the
I got to take a break. I got to take a break. I got Christine coming up, and we're about to, you know, we got another hour to go. So hold on, take a break right now. And hold on, Mama D. I'll put you in the box, and we're going to go from there. We see me? Oh, and let's continue up next.
Just my children and my wife. Thank my lucky stars to be living here today. 'Cause the flag still stands for freedom, and they can't take that away. And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men today, 'cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA. From the lakes of Minnesota to the hills of Tennessee, across the plains of Texas, from sea to shining sea, from Detroit down to Houston, and New York to LA, there's pride in every American heart, and it's time we stand and say that I'm proud to be an American, where at least today, 'cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA. And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me. And I gladly defend her still today.
Times journalist and architect of the 1619 Project, a Pulitzer Prize-winning series of articles that recontextualizes the central roles that slavery and racism played in America's founding. Those articles are now being taught in some public schools, even though numerous critics of the project have raised questions about very basic factual issues in some of the pieces. Indeed, five historians wrote to the New York Times that the 1619 Project basic historical facts wrong. They wrote, quote, "We ask that the Times, according to its own high standards of accuracy and truth, issue prominent corrections of all the errors and distortions presented in the 1619 Project. We also ask for the removal of these mistakes from any materials destined for use in schools, as well as in all further publications, including books bearing the name of the New York Times. One notable mistake, for instance, was the idea that defending slavery was a principal cause of the Revolutionary War. A Northwestern University history professor who had fact-checked the article for the Times vigorously objected to that contention. But according to her, the Times ignored her. The errors within the 1619 Project have been well publicized. People who tune into conservative TV, radio, and print are well informed about them. And thus they object to including this flawed work in the curriculum for K-12. Perhaps it should come as no surprise, then, that Hannah Jones is uncomfortable leaving curriculum decisions to people who are not district officials and would thus be less inclined to teach her work. Yes, in a Sunday interview on Meet the Press, Hannah Jones confessed that she did not understand this idea that parents should decide what's being taught. That's a quote.
I don't really understand this idea that parents should decide what's being taught. I'm not a professional educator. I don't have a degree in social studies or science. We send our children to school because we want them to be taught by people who have expertise in the subject area. And that is not my job. When the governor or the candidate said that he didn't think parents should be deciding what's being taught in school, he was panned for that. But that's just the fact. This is why we send our children to school and don't homeschool, because these are the professional educators who have the expertise to teach social studies, to teach history, to teach science, to teach literature. And I think we should leave that to the educators. Yes,
Her statement echoed widely panned comments made by former Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe during the 2021 gubernatorial race against Republican challenger Glenn Youngkin. McAuliffe's statement denying that parents should play a paramount role in the education of their own children is rightly seen as a realigning moment, one that allowed Youngkin to run and win on a platform of making the public education system accountable to families. But Hannah Jones seems to believe that McAuliffe had it right, even if his comments were unpopular. As it turns out, the idea that parents should broadly surrender their rights to public school officials is both unpopular and, in my opinion, misguided. And yes, it's possible for parents to become too involved in school affairs, no doubt, getting individual books removed from library shelves, for instance. But much of what parents have found objectionable in the past year is truly eyebrow-raising. As I wrote last January in an article I wrote for Reason Magazine titled "An Anti-Racist Education for Middle Schoolers," quote, "Fairfax Public Schools in Virginia invited Ibram X. Kendi, an activist and author of the books How to Be an Anti-Racist and Anti-Racist Baby, to have a virtual conversation with principals, administrators, and teachers. Kendi, who was paid $20,000 to speak for 1 hour, believes that the Constitution should be amended to create a federal Department of Anti-Racism with the power to censor public officials who make racist statements. The district also bought $24,000 worth of his books, which argue that any arrangement producing unequal results along racial lines is racist by definition. The National Education Association, for instance, wants schools to offer a critique of empire, white supremacy, anti-blackness, racism, patriarchy, cis-heteropatriarchy, capitalism, ableism, anthropocentrism, and other forms of power and oppression at the intersections of our society. That appeared in action item number 39 at the NEA's annual meeting last year. Now, it doesn't matter whether you define this sort of thing as critical race theory, though the NEA certainly does. It matters that activist educators are working to include it. The best solution to the education culture wars is to give parents the best kind of choice, school choice, instead of engaging in venomous, all-consuming battles over what schools should teach to students. Families should be empowered to take their education dollars, find a schooling option that best fits their children. This is a freedom that Nicole Hannah Jones should enjoy for her kids and that you should enjoy for your kids. During the Meet the Press interview, Hannah Jones made an attempt at consistency, taking the position that neither she nor other non-educators had the relative expertise to decide what should be taught in public schools. "I'm not a professional educator," she said. This is a somewhat confusing claim coming from someone who is currently a tenured professor at Howard University's School of Communications. She is quite literally a professional educator. But it shouldn't matter. Schools are clearly not immune to ideological capture. We have seen this in higher ed, and increasingly we are seeing it in K-12, where a kind of diversity training model that becomes popular in elite circles, college campuses, even corporate America, is filtering down to our kids in a really perverse and uneducational way. Parents don't need to leave this up to a scarcely accountable education bureaucracy. They have rights too. And, you know, I'd be happy to have a conversation with Nicole Hannah Jones, to have her on the show if she'd like to come on. I don't know if she'd be willing. I'm happy to reach out to her. I don't mean to, you know, pick on her. I think the 1619 Project had a lot of merit to it, and there was a lot of interesting new scholarship in it. But it did get some things wrong. This is not just like a conservative attack on this whole project. A lot of mainstream and liberal voices have objected to particularly how they characterize the Revolutionary War. It was not primarily fought to protect slavery. And it is being packaged in a way for some schools. And I don't kind of like this. Well, parents have no right to complain about that because they're not educators, and we're just going to leave all these decisions to a cabal of like totally unaccountable education officials who are increasingly interested in like these trendy diversity kind of things.
Yeah. So if you're looking for something to counteract CRT, you can go to TillmanFamilyPress.com and pick up Tillman's handbook on great Black American patriots. It's an answer to the critical race theory. Coming up is candidate Christine McGovern, who's running for office. We're going to let her come in and speak upon that. And let's see what she got to say about the stuff we was talking about or about her campaign. So we're about to bring her in right now. And if you hit the top, I think my button ain't hitting work for you. Yeah, bring Christine in. Yep. Hold on. No, you're wrong. I got that. I got you. You drew wrong button.
A little bit.
That's okay. That's okay. I got that. Hey, Christine, how you doing?
Oh, well. How are you? Can you hear me?
Hear me? Can you hear me?
I can hear. Yeah. Can you hear me?
Of course I can hear you. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thanks for having me on.
Well, somebody, you got to get you pressed, don't you? So let's talk about your campaign. So what are you running for and where is it at?
I'm running for Illinois State Senate, District 18, in the southwest side of Chicago and the suburbs. Evergreen Park, Oak Lawn, Palos, Tip of Orland, you know, as far east as 87th and Ashland. I'm very excited about my race. You know, a lot of things have to be changed. And I know when you reached out to me to talk about voter integrity, and first of all, thank you to Mama D for offering all of her knowledge. I learned a lot from your information that you shared tonight. So thank you for that. You know, when you ask me about voter integrity, what we have to remember is with our history, so many people fought and died to protect our democracy. And, you know, part of our democracy is the right to vote. They died so that our vote counts. And I believe that voter integrity is extremely important. You know, we want to make sure that our vote counts and our vote counts for what we stand for. And the only way to assure that is we need to have honest, you know, county clerks and secretaries of state that oversee the elections, that there's no corruption going on. We need to make sure, which the Southwest Republican Party is doing, that we have election judges and poll watchers to make sure that our side is being represented correctly. You know, we want to make sure that there is an audit on these voter rolls so that the votes that come in are legitimate voters. I believe, like Mama D said, we should have a voter registration. We need to have an ID to vote. If you need an ID to
to get your driver's license. And now with all of this vaccine, you need to carry a vaccine card. Then why do you not need to have an ID to vote? It doesn't make any sense, except for the fact for those sanctuary people, the settlers, as Mama D had said, who are not natural citizens, for them to vote, which they don't have a right to vote, in my opinion. So we have to eliminate the voter registration fraud. Also, you know, we have to talk about and talk honestly about the ballot harvesting and who's handling the ballots. I think that we have to be able to trust the process and make sure that our rights are protected, that they're not violated. And obviously, I don't believe anyone is discouraged from voting. I don't think that our process is set up to prevent people from voting. You know, we have the absentee voting, we have the early voting, and then we have the day of the voting. So going back to why you initially asked me to come on, to have voter integrity, you know, when I'm elected, I want to do things and to make steps to make sure that our voter integrity is in place and that every vote counts and that it's a representation, a true representation of who that person is voting for. That's what's important to me. So, you know, it's exciting. I think that my campaign is a grassroots campaign. People are frustrated. They're frustrated because they see what's happening in our community. They see what's happening in our crime. They see what's happening in our schools. They haven't seen yet how much our taxes are going to go up, and then everyone, I think, is going to go up in arms. But we have to change our vote. We have to vote for someone who, you know, believes in faith, believes in family, and believes in our freedom, and that's me. I will represent all of those parts, representing our community and representing my district. It's just time to get involved. It's time to vote new in 22.
New in 22. That's funky. What I'm about to say is this. Excuse me. What are the needs and desires of the citizens in that district that they're not receiving from Springfield?
Well, let's talk more on a local level first. Right now, my district, and we are known for being a very safe community. Unfortunately, right now, it's not. Unfortunately, right now, we are seeing carjackings and armed robberies. Just the heightened amount of crime is something that I've never experienced living in this community. I've been here for 25 years. My neighbors are upset by that. You know, when a mom and a child is in their driveway coming home from school and they get carjacked in their driveway in broad daylight, and then they're frustrated because the people who do it, the criminals, are not accountable. So what's happening with Kim Fox and the, you know, no bail reform and not making our criminals accountable, that is the most frustrating part right now. We feel that our voices are not being heard. We feel that our alderman is not taking the steps to protect our community. And this is nothing new. It's all over. It's been talked about. We know that our police officers are being moved to protect the businesses downtown, although the mayor thinks that they should hire their own security team to protect their own businesses. Going back to the crime, there was a situation where there were some kids who were at the local park and four criminals who pulled up in a stolen vehicle. Two of them got out of their car with masks on and assaulted the kids, asked for their cell phones. One girl put up a fight. They kicked her, they dragged her, they punched her, they choked her, they tried to get her in the car. That is something that is very alarming to us. Right after that, I went to a Christmas party where the children who were shot or affected by shootings attended a Christmas party and received gifts. And it was a very humbling experience for me because to see all of the kids that are affected in our neighborhood that are shot innocently by criminals that have no accountability. They're just on their porch. They're in their home. They're in a car. The lack of moral compass of these people, the lack of human life, the value of life is what's most alarming in my neighborhood.
Wow, carjacking broad daylight over there. That's very interesting. And all the police officers.
Yes. Look
at that is wild. Even I think state senator Lightfoot. Lightfoot got carjacked. He said, but you know, she was against she was a defunding police and still carrying her husband got some shots off. But as a state senator, how can you use your office to address that problem?
Well, I think first of all, we need to get some common sense. You know, this whole situation started even before the corona pandemic, with the division and separation from our governor, who used the words essential, non-essential. So there was a purposeful division. They closed the businesses. They closed the churches. They closed the schools. They closed any kind of normalcy to have people become even more desperate. Now, desperation is no, you know, that does not give you the right to cause harm to anyone. That does not give you the right to become a criminal. But through all of that and through that, the group, which had the wrong initiative, the Black Lives Matter, which, again, their cause was to cause division. It certainly was not to invest in any of the neighborhoods in Chicago or invest in any of the after-school programs or any of the crime initiative, anti-crime initiative. Their quest was to divide and to get their Democratic partners elected. We all know that. So the first start is to change these laws, to amend them so that criminals can go and be accountable for their actions. You know, that is extremely important. Also, what's happening in our schools, so that's very, very important to me. Like you had talked about the CRT and the sexualization. Our Illinois schools are lacking in the fundamental growth of our core subjects. I am a huge proponent of school choice. I think you should have a right to choose where you want to go to school, and I think that your dollar should follow where your child attends. I am a substitute for CPS. I think that Chicago Teachers Union, they are not looking out for the best interest of the kids. They're only looking out for the best interest of a handful of the teachers that have more of a vocal, liberal outlook. I see it. I see what's in the classroom. I see that there's a shortage of counselors. There's a shortage of support staff in the schools. Instead of, you know, using the money to make signs for the transgender bathrooms and to let boys use girls' bathrooms, they should use that time and effort to give support to the students in those areas, in the incentive school areas that need it, you know, where their life, real life struggles need to be addressed. So when I'm elected, I want to obviously change the accountability for the criminals. I want to decrease the authority that our government has over us. This is a country that's built on we the people, not we the government. And I think that we have lost our way with that and elected these officials that have no connection to the real people. They're in there doing and making decisions for their lobbyists, not for the people that live in their district. We need to just get back to the basics, get back to common sense, and make steps that's going to promote businesses to come to Illinois, not flee Illinois. Make steps to have our neighborhoods be one that are ones where people gravitate to and families gravitate to, where they want to raise their family, not move out because they're afraid of the crime. And let's talk about our property taxes. You know, our property taxes are going to continuously increase if we don't have businesses that are going to support with their taxes that they pay. Elk Lawn, I believe, lost 33% of their businesses through the COVID. That is huge. And I blame the governor for that. I blame JCAR. I blame them for giving the executive power to the governor. You know, again, going with that same concept of reducing the government authority, businesses should be allowed to stay open. Businesses should not have been in that position where they had a risk losing their liquor license or keeping their employees there. It's almost like it's just like we're in Lulu land, we're in La La land, Bromper Room. I'm not sure how we got here. I'm not even sure, you know, it's good versus evil right now. And then you get into the church concept and to the faith concept and closing the churches. And there were there were a few churches that stayed open. The pastors fought hard and continued their worshiping and I attended those services, and I believe I attended them plenty with you also. And it's important to keep the faith and to build the faith. And going back to your original question, what would I do? Well, the main thing is to make the criminals accountable for the action. That is the most important. Our communities need to be safe. Our people need to feel safe. Our children need to be able to play at the park. Next, we need to make sure that our education in our school is not dividing the kids. We're losing the insight as to what's important. Our kids are struggling. We should have the best educational system in the world right now, and we don't, and that's sad. After that, we have to figure out how we can decrease our taxes, and that the main purpose of that is to stop the overspending.
No, I don't know. I lost you. Now hold on, because you went there. Are you still there? Christine, still there?
I am. Yeah.
All right, back. Because you was hot. So I'm gonna take a break. I'm gonna come right back there with you in 1 second. So give me about that. Just one little news update, because you struck a chord to me when you said about these trans in the bathrooms. We're gonna be right back with Christine. Bring you back in, Mama Dave. You're still there? But I'm going to leave you with this note, Christine. I'm just even come back and ask her, you know, how to answer, which I ain't going to try to put no curveballs. You know, we just playing around up here on the radio. But what do you think now I'm going to play a little commercial break, what have you, give you some time to think about it. But what do you think the citizens of Orland Park, what are they looking for from Springfield, and what are their needs? And I'll be right back after this break. Well, here you go, Evan.
Month, the Transgender Law Center posted results from what appears to be the most comprehensive set of polling and focus group research ever released to the public on the question of trans rights. For trans advocates, there are a few cautiously optimistic findings, but more broadly, it warns of a very rocky political road ahead. The research seems to have gotten virtually zero coverage in the press, so let's go over what they found and then move on to what recommendations they make based on their findings. The clearest finding, and the one that raised the most alarms for the memo's authors, is that trans activists are getting destroyed on the question of sports. For most of the survey questions, the memo includes the numbers, even when solid majorities of the country are lined up against trans activists on a particular question. When it comes to sports, the numbers are so bad they aren't included. Instead, the memo describes the results like this. Quote, right now, our opposition wins the debate on trans youth and sports against any and all arguments we have tried for our side. There is a huge gap in awareness and concern, with most base and persuadable respondents unaware of proposals regarding transgender girls' participation in sports, while a strong majority of our opposition has heard some or a lot about it. So in polling language, what they're saying is that even after a person heard all of their arguments, all of the arguments that trans activists make about the question, the person still fell on the other side of it. It's not surprising that the poll found supporters were largely unfamiliar with the entire issue, while opponents knew a ton about it. That comes from our polarized media, in which mainstream news outlets largely ignore this issue, while right-wing outlets obsess over it. If you largely get your news from the New York Times and MSNBC, and I ask you if you've been following the story of the UPenn swimmer, I'll probably get a blank stare in return. If you watch Fox or you're into college swimming, you know the story. The short version is that Leah Thomas is now setting women's swimming records after having previously competed for the UPenn men's swimming team. Her success has parents complaining about the NCAA rules, and the story has been covered heavily by conservative media, while mostly ignored by the mainstream media. The polling memo hints at why that might be. The authors say that they lose significant support even among their base when the opposition argues that this is fundamentally unfair. They write, quote, "When pressed, our audiences hold contradictory views, with a third supporting both a policy to ensure transgender student athletes can play on the team that matches their gender identity and a policy to require that student athletes play on the team matching their, quote, biological sex. Our base and persuadables want to support transgender student athletes, but are extremely susceptible to our opposition's argument that excluding trans youth is necessary to protect the fairness of women's sports," unquote. The good news for trans acts is that the memo found some language and framing that can move the needle on other issues, even though it doesn't work when it comes to sports. The memo recommends what it calls a race, class, gender narrative. Now, that's clearly derived from the race, class narrative. And one of the key developers of that concept, Anat Shankar Osorio, helped put this memo together. The polling firm, Lake Research Partners, that helped put together the race, class narrative also put this one together. The race-class narrative is an update on a theme that 19th century populists pushed, most famously by Tom Watson, who said to white and black farmers famously, quote, "You are kept apart that you may be separately fleeced of your earnings. You are made to hate each other because upon that hatred is rested the keystone of the arch of financial despotism which enslaves you both." The contemporary version doesn't include cool phrases like the keystone of the arch of financial despotism, but the theme is the same. And one reason it's so persuasive is that it's completely true. Indeed, like the root of the very idea of race is tied up in the need of elites to oppress one race and pit poor people of another race against them so that they can't unite and challenge those elites. The trans rights memo suggests a similar tack. Specifically, the memo argues, quote, "We can and should connect justice for transgender people to issues of racial and economic justice, and by doing so, we move our base and persuadable audience on key metrics of support," unquote. The problem, the research found, is that many people think of trans issues as, quote, a white person problem, quote, "The implicit and occasionally explicit line people drew between their own communities and transgender people frequently had a racial dimension, with comments indicating many participants largely associated being transgender with being white or associated acceptance of transgender people with whiteness," unquote. The strategy of linking trans rights to racial justice echoes a strategy advocated in a widely distributed 2019 memo that analyzed the rapid success of the trans rights movement in several European countries. One of the key lessons learned was, quote, "Tie your campaign to more popular reform." Specifically, it cited the success of linking trans rights to marriage equality and moving it all forward at once. It also then advised, quote, "Avoid excessive press coverage and exposure." It reads, "Another technique which has been used to great effect is the limitation of press coverage and exposure. In certain countries, like the UK, information on legal gender recognition reforms has been misinterpreted in the mainstream media and opposition has arisen as a result," unquote. The report warns that the news coverage can drive hate crimes against trans youth and that policy can be changed without it. Quote, "Against this background, many believe that public campaigning has been detrimental to progress, as much of the general public is not well informed about trans issues, and therefore misinterpretation can arise. In Ireland, activists have directly lobbied individual politicians and tried to keep press coverage to a minimum in order to avoid this issue. Similarly, in Norway, campaigners developed strong ties with youth politicians who then presented to the senior members of their parties on the changes that were needed. This technique was effective at persuading more senior politicians as the changes were being suggested from within their own party rather than an external organization. We also saw this technique in Denmark," unquote. The new memo points rather clearly to the problem with that strategy that is now being confronted. It's easier to avoid press coverage of a public policy debate, but once the policy is in place and things are happening in the real world, the press will eventually cover it. Directly and quietly lobbying politicians might win their support for a new law or a new policy, but if it doesn't have public support or public understanding, eventually its opponents will overwhelm and repeal it. Trans activists also have to be sure their strategy of linking the cause to racial justice doesn't backfire, as the memo suggests it does in some instances. So one of the arguments that lessened opposition began by noting that, quote, women's sports have never existed on an equal playing field. And it goes on to cite pay disparities before getting into trans women's participation in sports. Another version of that argument, which tried to link the unfairness to the way black women athletes are treated unfairly, worked among supporters to increase their level of support, but, quote, considerably increased the margin by which we lost persuadables and all racial groups, including black adults, unquote. The good news came in that some of the messaging was indeed able to move the numbers, but even then, the movement is underwater on key issues. Respondents were asked to agree or disagree with two different statements. One, there are two genders, men and women, determined by biological sex at birth, or the alternative, quote, gender is determined by who we know ourselves to be. Those considered persuadable chose the first by 24 points, even after all of the messaging. But by pluralizing the second and saying genders are determined rather than gender is determined, they were able to make more movement in their direction. But even after that, 55% of their persuadable audience was still against the idea that genders are determined by who we know ourselves to be. The trans rights movement has made enormous gains, but not hashing this all out in public isn't going to work forever. And this memo is the first tentative step in the direction of recognizing that.
Let's be honest, guys, with everything happening in the world.
Produced by, you know, a team of, you know, extraordinarily well-respected and successful kind of progressive organizers and researchers, you know, taking a deep look inside the hood of the movement to say what's working and what's not working. And this is their advice going forward. Another thing that they mentioned is that currently a lot of trans activists lead with the argument about discrimination and harm that comes from their opponents are inflicting on them. The memo says don't lead with that. That doesn't work. That it actually backfires. That you have to lead. If you lead with a positive vision of everyone, including trans people, should be able to live a free life, that is the way that you can move the numbers in your direction. I'm not. We'll see how well it's received.
We actually are going to accuse these people of violence against trans. Like that, I mean, this is what happens whenever you tangle with activists on the subject online or elsewhere. You get, no matter how, they will accuse the most otherwise progressive people, people who agree with them on, you know, 95% of the way, who want.
This is the Transgender Law Center.
Yeah, well.
This is, I mean, we'll see. We'll see if you're.
They've run trans people out of the, right, out of their movement for not, you know, they've, I see them go after Natalie Wynn, who ContraPoints, who's a very good YouTuber on progressive issues, on trans issues. And every now and then she says something that, you know, sends them into some kind of crazy unhinged rant. Look, I mean, this, the swimmer case, it's hard to be on the other side. She's swimming laps around other players in this field. It does seem unfair. I don't know what the solution is going to be, but it
right. And the memo doesn't have one.
It doesn't have one. I mean,
the memo like says that their solution was to. They said the problem that they encounter with people is that people see sports as a zero sum game. Some people win, some people lose. Yes, that is how people see sports. They tried
what sports is.
This was so they tried to reframe it as it's a learning experience. It's team sports is about collectively working together in a community spirit. And they said it just didn't really. They could move the needle on some subgroups with that argument, but in general, it came nowhere near winning. And that's the best that they have.
I mean, it's just
right now.
We have to, like, there is a real component to biology, to biological sex. Now, I think trans people deserve all the dignity and should make whatever choices are good for them. I think a lot of our, you know, gender-separated spaces don't need to be gender-separated. You know, the public restroom at the airport or the bar, who cares? The more separation between one person and any other person in the restroom, fine. If gender separation, who cares? When you're talking about high school locker rooms, you know, there's a lot of bullying and unpleasantness that goes along in those spaces. Those spaces should probably be reformed irrespective of the trans question. But I can see that it's a little bit more of a delicate issue. And then with this, I mean, what do you want to – like people who had the biological faculties of men or of young men before transitioning just have a extreme and overwhelming advantage because there is massive – you know, biological sex-based disparity in physical ability. It's true. It's just true. There are not differences between the races. There are differences between men and women. Gender is rooted in a biological reality to a greater degree than race or any these other things.
And what this research memo from the Transgender Law Center says is that the view that you just expressed here is widely the majority view,
yeah,
and they have work to do in grappling,
yeah,
with that.
But that doesn't mean we can absolutely treat trans people with dignity and respect and equality in a wide variety of situations where they have been stigmatized and they have not been granted equality. Absolutely, but there are a couple tough cases where, I'm sorry, there are certain realities that we can't work past, in my view.
Yeah, transgender, trans, these biological. I want to run a little clip and give my girl some time to come up with an answer, but like she was saying, all these young bathrooms in these grammar schools and high schools that are unisex or bathrooms. And my hope is this, is kids should keep their innocence. Kids should still have their innocence feedback abilities. I hear too. Let me bring Christine back in here.
Let me just answer your question before I jump on with that topic. You know, Orland Park in Chicago, although it's the same district, what's happening now is, I'm sure that you heard about what happened at the Oakbrook Mall. And...
Yes.
You know, people in the suburbs, they don't want the criminals glowing out to the, you know, into the suburbs. They want the safety. Safety is a huge aspect. You know, I kind of looked online. Chicago has a crime index of 9. Orland Park is 42, 100 being the best. Safety is extremely, extremely important. But what they have in Orland that we don't have in Chicago, our mayor in Chicago is a Soros-backed liberal, I'm going to say racist because I believe she is, person who does not care about the inner cities. She does not care about the educational system. In Orland, they have a mayor that cares about the students, that care about the safety, that care about the businesses. I mean, he just came out publicly and said, there's no data to back up this vaccine mandate that they want businesses to have, you know, in indoor dining or gyms or entertainment industry. It just doesn't make sense. And he's been very vocal about that throughout this entire almost 2 years. So the difference between Chicago and Orland is leadership. You know, and you look at their schools, too. If you look under there's a place called Neighborhood Scout. Orland, their high schools are ranked number 18 in Chicago, although we have one of the best gifted schools, selective enrollment schools. CPS schools as a whole is not in the top 100. So the needs are a little bit different. The leadership is quite different. But the goals are the same, faith, family, and freedom. That's what everyone wants in my district. They want to make sure that they can practice their faith as they wish. They want to make sure that no government is going to close their churches again. They want to make sure that they can provide for their family, that they're not going to lose their job. And obviously, they want to make sure that their freedom, which we talked about in the beginning of this call,
you know, the whole democracy and how many people fought for our democracy and for our democracy to count and for us to be able to vote. You know, we can't let those deaths go in vain. And that's going to protect our freedom. So I think the needs are similar, and that should be similar across the whole state. That should be similar across the whole nation. Now, when you touch base too, and you talked about the gender craziness, chaos, immoral that's happening. You know, I don't care what you want to do as an adult. As an adult, you have the life experience, you have the emotional, mental availability to make a decision of what you want to do with your body. Children do not have that. This is being pushed upon them in the schools. In my opinion, it's being pushed upon them because they want to make pedophilia a sexual orientation. I have talked about this for years. People thought I was out of my mind, and now here we are. There are people who are called MAP now, minor attractive people. That's a pedophilia. There's no way around it. You know, there was a thing going on where men winning beauty pageants. I'm a mom of a daughter who did pageants. She worked very hard and practiced. And what are we teaching our girls that say, hey, there's nothing different between you and him. There's everything different. God made us different. We should not be teaching this purposeful misalignment of our natural born bodies. Now, in CPS, if a child comes to you and says, hey, Ms. McGovern, I want to be called a boy today, we cannot call the parent. That is wrong. Faith, family, freedom are not domestic terrorists. We are responsible for our children. It is our role to take care of our children, not the government, not the teachers, not the schools, not the school boards. It's the parental responsibility to decide what is best for our children. That's what is important.
Family. Now, as a state senator, how can how can you prevent that from happening? What type of legislation can you pass? Oh, since you said it has happened already, what can you do? It's already been signed into law. The sexualization of our children has already been signed into law. What is it that you can do as a state senator?
Well, the obvious is once this state changes red and we get some common sense legislators in there, and just how they changed the sexual bill, they changed the defund the police. You know, all these moronic bills have to be rewritten and have to be amended. And once you get people in there who have a moral compass and people elected who want what's best for our Midwestern values, that's how we can rewrite and sponsor new bills to get this idiotic, progressive path that's happening to stop.
A lot of people are leaving the town. A lot of businesses are leaving. What do you have any plan or any idea to stop businesses from leaving the state? Or do you have a plan or do you have an idea or what can you suggest or bring to the Senate floor that can stop this exit that we have in here or the loss of corporations that are leaving our state?
Well, you know, going down to downtown, I was just at the River North Business Association Christmas party, and I talked with the businesses there, and their main concern, again, is the safety of their customers. Their concern is the safety of their employees because they're afraid. Why are they afraid? Because the police can't do their job. Why can't they do their job? Because of our governor and our mayor. And we need to make our neighborhood safe so that people feel comfortable and will continue to come to the city. You know, I was at another event for commercial businesses. They cannot find renters to set up shop in their retail fronts because they know the risk of it being robbed. So until we get crime under control, we're not going to get the businesses. That is the number one issue, in my opinion, that is preventing. We're being taxed. The businesses are being taxed at a far rate higher than our neighboring states. That needs to change. That is something that policy will change on that, and I need to get more versed on that, and I am aware of the issue and the tax increments with our businesses. And, you know, it's cheaper for businesses to do their to set up shop in Wisconsin. It shouldn't be that way. We should be encouraging more businesses to come to our state. We have a great state. We have great people that live here. We have a beautiful state. We have different opportunities for different businesses all over. You know, we're a farming state. We're an industrial state. Why are we not utilizing this? Because it's not financially beneficial for the owners. So we need to make it financially beneficial.
My, my business is in Indiana because of the high corporate taxes. But dig this up. I had a homeboy pass away. He was a state senator. Can you hear me?
Oh, I can hear you now. I could not hear you previously.
But it went down. Okay. Point out scenario, we got 10 minutes. Lord have mercy, I did a 3-minute speech. You got 10 minutes to go. Okay, listen. Martin Sandoval passed this high gas tax before he passed away. He should resign because the man ain't going away. He was saying something about, since we're moving to electric vehicles, and we're going to not make enough money off the gas taxes because everybody going to electric vehicles, and how can we make little money? So from that point on, we don't went up on our gas prices. What type of idea, what type of relief, what type of solution that you can bring to the citizens of your district with that are struck with this high burden? Now, I know we got the city tax, we got the county tax, but is there any somewhere we can get relief from the state tax, seeing how it's harming most everybody, almost your residents, almost the whole, most all the state of Illinois? Do you have any idea, any plan, any thoughts about how you can try to bring the price of gas down?
Well, let's talk about what was voted with the energy bill.
Right.
And let's talk about the corruption with ComEd and decisions that are being made from our people who are elected, not for the benefit of us, yet who is receiving money from these utilities bills in their election campaign, and why they're making the decisions that they're making. I mean, this energy bill that was passed, it's making – we're going to have the highest heating bills in I don't know how many years in Illinois. On the face of a time when people are struggling, when so many people have lost their jobs, you know, I can speak for myself. I had tenants, very good tenants, good people, but their business was closed down. They weren't able to pay. People think that there are so many resources out there to help people like myself, you know, whose tenants are and were at one time over $10,000 back in their pay, you know, in their rent. There's so many different things that need to happen, and that is something that I look forward to presenting on my website with different policies that's going to help all of our Illinois people. Because you're right, we are struggling.
We are struggling. Hold on, Christine. I'll bring you back in for a minute. I got two callers coming in. I got 7 minutes. I want to see what they have to say before I talk it out. Mama D, I'm going to come back to you, Mama D, so everybody can know where they can find you. And Christine, I'll come back to you. Same information, your website and page, so they can find you at too. Let me get this one caller, see what is going on. It's just hamming up. I didn't take home that long, man. What's going on?
Oh, nothing's going on. But I was going to say a couple of things. One about the John Lewis bill. That bill's not needed. If states want to implement that, they should. I don't know why he wants that to be a federal law. It mentions nothing about black people. It talks about Native Americans and then about letting illegals, well, like New York is letting illegals vote in their local election. And one other thing, there needs to be a separate federal, state, and local ballot. The federal ballot should be for Congress people, U.S. senators, president, vice president. And there should be rules that are for vetting those who vote on that ballot. And that's the only way I think that you're ever going to have a free and transparent federal election. Now, leave the states alone. If the states want to have whatever, leave them alone, because all 50 states are not going to walk in line. But the Constitution provides for Congress to set the rules and regulations on that federal ballot. And that's what they need to do. It needs to be a positive identification system, similar to like the U.S. passport. You got all sorts of technology, things that can read the iris of your eyes, and you can have blockchain-type identification number that matches your card, the envelope of a mail-in ballot, and the mail-in ballot. There's ways to correct that where they can't cheat, like we've seen the cheating going on before.
Well, it's good to hear you, Bianchi. You know I got a book out. You can go to TillmanFamilyPress.com and check out my book. I got it's hot. It's Tillman's Handbook of Great Black American Patriots. You'll love it. You go to Tillman's.
I'll go check it out.
This is me, Mama D. I know you. Anything else you want to say?
No, that's all right now. You ready?
All right. Mama D.
To ask about the mandate, to teach kindergartners sex education when there's no mandate to teach them how to know their ABCs or how to read, and about the mandate that you don't have to give parental consent when your young daughter is having major abortion surgery, and yet you have to take your child to the clinic if they have a sore throat. So I don't understand these abomination laws and spiritual crime bills that indoctrinating our children, not educating them. I'd like to have her opinion on that and how we can drum up more support for school choice and stop sending our children to various levels of segregated education.
Hey, Christine, that question was for you.
Yes, and you know, thank you for saying that, because sometimes I feel like I'm on a boat by myself. And when that bill was signed that allowed our young girls to have an abortion without parental consent, to me, that just eliminates any kind of moral support for them if they are being sexually abused. They are taking the responsibility of our children away. And again, like you said, the sexualization of our kids, there are priests out there and there are pastors that are giving seminars on this very subject. And I can send you the information. You'll learn so much from it. I learned so much from it. The movement of homeschooling has grown tremendously. Again, it's almost like I always use the concept moral compass, and it's not a wishy-washy word. I honestly believe that we don't have a moral compass, and we're not instilling that into our kids, the parents' job. It's certainly not the school's job to push our children to learn about sex or gender identity. That's the parents' job. Like you said, it's the school's job to teach the core subjects. We need to change the whole momentum, and there is a growing momentum that is supporting, just from what I'm reading and from different school board meetings that I'm going to. We need to give control back to the school boards and let them decide what is best for their students in their school. Every school is different, and that's what people don't realize. Every school has different needs. And the churches have to get involved. I don't understand what the lack of support that some of these churches are. And they're just allowing these mandates and allowing this curriculum to go into the school. And these are private schools that are allowing this to teach. And these are private schools that are hosting vaccine clinics.
You got 90 seconds. Tell everybody
I got 90 seconds. Okay, McGovern for IllinoisSenate.com. So it's McGovernForIllinoisSenate.com. That's my website. And you can find me online at Christine Shanahan McGovern for Senate District 18.
Okay. Well, what about you, Mama D? Where can we reach you at, Mama D?
Well, you can his story or the truth at gmail.com. HISSTORYOR the truth at gmail.com or 773-RESPECT,
773-737-7328. All right. Bianchi, I just got back on here, and I'm glad you checked in on me, but I was wondering if I could reach you, and I was hoping that you get my book. I'm trying to get on your man's show in Canada. You know, the show you had me on that time, so listen. It's TillmanFamilyPress.com. And matter of fact, Bianchi, if you can email Ebony, you can send Ebony your information. I'll mail you one. I'll autograph if you want to send you one. But you can check that out right there.
Yeah, I'll do that. And I'll give you, I think I gave you my cell phone address on your Facebook Messenger. If I didn't, I'll do it again. My cell phone number.
All right,
Mama D, I agree with you on the school choice and the ridiculousness of a young underage girl being able to have an abortion without parental input. That's totally ridiculous.
All right.
I just think that some former slave owners are going to have to sit at the table of brotherhood like Reverend Dr. Prophet King said. If we love this country more, then we're supposed to hate each other. And every time you eliminate a slave owner history, you erase the history of the slave.